Good morning. In the early hours of February 14th, 1981, a fire at the Stardust nightclub in Artane in North Dublin claimed the lives of 48 people. On Thursday, 43 years after that fire, a 12-person jury delivered the verdicts of unlawful killing to a packed courtroom in the Pillar Room on the grounds of the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin city centre. On Drive Time, Una Kelly joined Cormac.
Can you bring me back to the moment when the jury delivered the verdict of unlawful killing, Una? I know there was an outpouring of emotion and passion, wasn't there?
There certainly was, Cormac. I was standing just in the back of the room, so the families were seated. The room was absolutely packed. Most of the legal representatives had given up their seats so that the families could sit down. Over on the left is where most of them were. They were holding photographs of their loved ones. They were sitting underneath photos of all 48. Now, when the verdicts were coming, they went through all 48. First of all, it was just about the identification, the date that they were identified, the cause of death, the date of death, and the place of death. The family sat there just silently, looking quite impassive. But then it got into the verdicts about the cause of the fire. And when the moment came where it was said that the fire was caught, the jury were saying that the fire was caused by an electrical fault in the hot press. There were some gasps and murmurs at that point then. We then also heard that the fact that the exits, some of the exits were locked that night, had impeded the ability of people to access the exits and escape that night. And then the big moment where it came to the final verdict of unlawful killing. Just before that, the tension in the room was really something else. And when unlawful killing was announced, some of the family stood up. They cheered, they were hugging, they were crying. Some were just sitting down. You could see in the seconds before, some had their hands together saying a prayer, and the relief that washed over them when that came. Then the coroner, Moira Cullinan, had to ask for some calm in the court for the proceedings to finish. Things then calmed down, but you could just hear people crying in the courtroom, the sounds of sobbing muffled, echoing all around there. Yeah. And then when you came out, it was just people looking either thrilled or slightly stunned, hugging each other, just completely relieved that this journey had come to an end.
More than 90 days of evidence and testimony from 373 witnesses was heard at the inquiry into the deaths of the 48 people aged between 16 and 27. After the verdict, solicitor for a majority of the families, Darren Macken, spoke at the press conference and paid tribute to the coroner, Dr. Cullinan.
A campaign started by powerful women was finished today by a powerful woman. Dr. Myra Cullinan, the senior coroner, did what others couldn't. Yeah. Dr. Cullinan restored their identity. She restored their humanity. And most importantly, she restored their faith in the rule of law. Dr. Cullinan exceeded where many failed. She succeeded in ensuring that the law applies equally to everyone. Today marks an end to the perception that the law only favours the rich. It does not. The law favours the truth.
Yes, yes, yes.
And for the families, a legal victory after so many years fighting for justice.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anthony Keegan. I'm a survivor of the Stardust, and I also lost my two sisters, Mary and Martina Keegan. I just want to thank everyone. I want to thank Phoenix Law, our legal team, all the barristers, the whole lot of this. Well, overwhelming day today. I also want to thank Lynn Boyle and Tommy Brown as well, who've done a lot for us in the past. We can't leave him out. And this day is for the 48. And I also want to remember my mother, who I've been so proud to stand beside today, along with Eugene Kelly and Charlie Gord. So, justice for the 48. Yeah.
Speaking to Sarah on Drive Time, Tony McCullough, who has co-written a book on the Stardust fire.
The inquest found today that a number of factors were found to have contributed to the difficulty of the crowd trying to leave the nightclub, and that included the failure of the lighting, the lack of staff preparedness, lack of visibility, and the jury found that at the time of the fire some or all of the exits were locked, chained or otherwise obstructed. How important are those findings, do you think?
Well, they're important now, but they were also important back then when the original tribunal investigation was underway. These were all issues, the fire exits, insufficient training of staff, the materials used that were completely unsuitable, like carpet tiles on the wall. These were all issues that were raised back in 1982. So it is absolutely unbelievable that it has just taken until today to arrive at these conclusions. And, you know, I think it's a credit to the coroner and to the jury that so much time was taken to interrogate the evidence that was presented in the course of almost a year. And you can't help wonder what would have happened at the original inquests back in March 1982, which only sat for 5 days by comparison. You can't help wonder what the outcome would be if they had arrived at the same conclusion back then. Like, would it have changed the outcome of the original tribunal report? Would it have impacted on the family's decision to accept the government's compensation? All sorts of elements like that. Mm. So I think today, while it is overall a very, very positive day, and, you know, it is no doubt a victory for the families, but we also have to look back and say, look, what has gone wrong over the decades and why did it take them so long to get here?
And on Late Debate with Colm, Orla Ryan from the Journal noted this obstacle put in the path of the families during this inquest.
The owner of the venue got redress for the property damage back in the early 80s, pretty promptly, a sum of over £500,000, which was a substantial sum in the money of the day.
Yeah, it was huge money back then, and we couldn't report on it until today. But Eamon Butterley, in the closing days of the inquest, he made a last-ditch attempt to prevent the jury from being able to consider the verdict of unlawful killing. He said it would be highly prejudicial and could damage his reputation. But ultimately, that effort did fail, and obviously we've gotten to the point today where the jury did find that conclusion.
And on Morning Ireland yesterday, Áine put this to Sean Murray of the Irish Examiner and co-creator of the Stardust podcast.
And one of the questions that's been asked about this 43 years to get that verdict of unlawful killing, Sean, if this fire had happened in a different part of Dublin, if this had been a more affluent, a better connected community, would it have taken so long to get this answer?
That was a refrain from the late, great Charlie Board, would frequently say that if this happened in Donnybrook instead of Bonnybrook, this would have been sorted a long time ago. And I think you can't ignore the class element of this, because it has hallmarks of what happened in Hillsborough as well, with the families, the working class families of Liverpool. I think it was easy for the state to ignore these families for so long. They'd given them their tribunal of inquiry at the time, and Ireland likes to move on. When the state has its final say, it likes to just push things aside and try and move on. But because of that arson verdict, because the families had never gotten the answers that they'd saw, they just couldn't give up. They couldn't give up. And it's an absolute credit to them. And I think they'd done a great service by not giving up. Because if another tragedy had happened in a working class area, that kind of precedent has been set. That if people had feel they'd been wronged, it was tough. They had to move on. But this relentless pursuit, this dogged pursuit, I think it is an absolute credit to them all.
And while there was a sense of vindication and relief at the outcome of Thursday's verdicts, the pain and loss of that night remains. Drive Time went into the archives to take us back to 1981, and this from what it says in the papers with P.P. O'Reilly.
St. Valentine's Day 1981 will be remembered in Dublin forever. In front of me, the horror of the Artane tragedy pulls at the heart as the Dublin papers cry out in many words and pictures the sorrows of the night, the loss of the young. I quoted random, said a garda in Store Street, people were out of their minds, all praying that they would not find their sons or daughters in the morgue. There were harrowing scenes of sadness, too, at the hospitals all over the city, as mothers and fathers went among the injured. There were scenes of great joy, too, as some parents found their children alive. And on the scene itself, the accounts of the survivors. The flames caused the lighting to fail. After a short period of complete darkness, the flames began to light up the inside of the hall. A huge cloud of black smoke was coming from the seats near the exit. It seemed so fast that everyone ran away from it, and they were running in the wrong direction because they were going to the end where everything was locked. I have never seen smoke that was so black. It irritated your throat and you could not breathe. A Garda spokesman in Coolock station said, I could hear people screaming through our radio in the police station. On the spot, the Gardaí kept the milling teenagers from the way of continuous streams of ambulances. Overheard were two pals. They found Paul. And how is he? He's dead.
On Thursday and Friday, Liveline covered the verdict and spoke to those left behind, their memories of that time and their loved ones. Here's Mark Fraser, whose sister Thelma was unlawfully killed in the fire along with her boyfriend, Michael Farrell. She was 20, he was 26.
On the morning of it, we were woken to Dad coming into the room shouting, "Has anybody seen Thelma?" She wasn't in the bed, but with Barbara in the next room.
Right.
Obviously, she'd been to the disco and they'd heard at 7:30 on the news, at 7:30 on Saturday morning, that there was a fire and Thelma wasn't home. Sometimes Thelma would stay over our granny in Dunnycarney. My dad and my eldest brother, Arthur, went around the hospitals, were advised to go travel around the hospitals, all the hospitals of Dublin, to see if there's any sign. There was missing lists put up. Dad was also in touch with Irishtown Garda Station at the time.
Right.
It was 3 days before Thelma was identified.
Oh, God.
By an electric watch that she'd only been given as a birthday present, as a Christmas present, and there was a necklace as well. So it was 3 days before we officially found out. But by the end of Saturday, we kind of knew, but we were still hoping that maybe there was all sorts of word going around that there was people rambling around the north side of the city had been involved in the fire and they were shocked and they were in neighbours' houses and people's houses and people were taking people in, and there was all sorts of stories going on. But it was 3 days later, through the necklace, the watch and dental records, was how Thelma was identified. Yeah. By the time Dad got home late in the evening, my mum was beside herself. She had to call the doctor out. Mum was put on medication, and Mum was never the same after that day. She was always on medication for it.
Okay.
And she had three young children. She had Eric was four or five, Barbara was I think six, and Robert was seven. So she, three young children in the house.
Mark Fraser, brother of Thelma. And the devastation of that night would rip through every family and the community. Liveline brought us the voice of Bridget McDermott speaking to Zara King on Thursday. Bridget lost three children in the fire, Willie, George and Marcella.
He came back and told us that there was a fire. And then my husband got up. He was a fireman, but he should have been on duty that night when he was off. It was a nightmare from then on. A pure nightmare. And still is. Yeah. Our marriage broke up. I said to Jimmy when this happened, we had to get justice. He said, no, we can't do that. We haven't the money anyway. And he said, I'd lose my job if I was to go to court, because he was in, I thought about it. I couldn't understand that. It not only took my children, but marriage as well.
Weldon Costello was a neighbour of the McDermotts and as a child remembered the devastation in the community, and in particular going with his mother to the funerals of those victims whose remains could not be identified.
Seven coffins in a line were the seven unidentified that were all in a line at Lartain Church. I was outside. I was 9.5 years of age, attended funerals. She placed seven red roses and she said, hopefully, and I can remember her words very well, hopefully their mammy and their daddy someday will know. I can never forget her words when she said that. I said, Mum, we don't know them. Why are you buying roses? My mother was a widow. And she said, someday their mothers and fathers will know who they are.
Yeah, and they did eventually with the
DNA. They did eventually, Joe.
Yeah, eventually, I know.
You know, but they were buried against a wall in Sutton in a line, in an unmarked grave for you.
I remember it.
And Siobhan Carney talked about searching for her brother Liam, who had initially survived the fire.
Well, that morning, my father walked the mother's private, one of my brothers, Alan. They were on nights. so they obviously heard that the fire in Stardust. They drove to see was Liam home, then they drove to the Stardust. My brother Alan has been traumatised since from what he's seen. We got up to the hospitals while my parents searched the morgue, because at that time there was no information coming through. So I was up in the Mata Hospital, walking through the wards, and I'll never forget the smell. I'll never forget the fear on the kids' faces. And then I walked into a ward and I spotted an old friend of mine called Bernard Hogan, whose brother Huey died in it. And I said, Bernard, I'm looking for Arlene. And he said, Siobhan, I'm looking for Huey. And I said, and Bernard said, well, your man in that corner over there says he's Liam Dunn. And Joe, I went over. And I was 16 years of age, and I think it was the first time I knew what fainting felt like, because Liam was so swollen and bandaged up, and he had a mask on to breathe, and he was coughing up black tar. And he was able to talk, Joe. He was able to talk, you know, and he told me, he said to me, Siobhan, I was crawling on the ground. The seats were not on fire, he said, but my hands were melting.
Liam would die on March 11th, 1981.
My poor mother came in that night, I'll never forget it, and she shut the sitting room door and fell down on the ground. And she said to me, Siobhan, he's not going to make it. My father had told me, but we were trying to protect our mother, because my mother was just devastated, Joe. They were never the same parents after that. Never the same parents, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, it's been like a lot of pain.
Like so many. And when you heard the phrase yesterday, Siobhan, unlawful killing.
Oh, I just said to myself, Liam, we've done it. We never gave up on you. We never gave up on you. Because to be even third, Joe, I've been called an arsonist. He was an 18-year-old young fella, trainee butcher, living life. He had applied for his first passport because they were all supposed to go to Tormelinas. It was Super Quinn, you know, they were all to go to Tormelinas that summer. And the naivety of them 16, you know, I was still saying to my parents, we'll get the passport while he's in hospital now, so he'll have something to look forward to. Not thinking that the Bournes, he'd never be able to sit in the sun, you know, but it didn't turn out like that, Joe, you know what I mean? He died at 10 to 12 on a Wednesday morning. Our lives just changed drastically. Grief and trauma. Grief you kind of deal with, but trauma seems to be put aside and just keeps coming back and hitting you.
Siobhan Carney speaking about her brother Liam on Liveline yesterday. And for families grieving loved ones and fighting for justice, Thursday's verdict was finally something like justice. They are now looking for a public apology from the government and are expected to meet Taoiseach Simon Harris later today. As part of the inquest process, pen portraits of each of the 48 people unlawfully killed were read by family members. The kind of person they were, the small details that you remember and that just might make you smile. On Morning Ireland, Áine spoke to Susan Behan, whose 21-year-old brother John Colgan died in the fire.
Tell me about your brother John.
What can I say? We've all got so many beautiful stories about our loved ones. But for me, he was super special, you know, to our family when he, you know, was taken from us unlawfully. It just ripped the, you know, the inside of our family, you know, apart, because he was so special to us. I jotted down a few memories in the pen portrait of the things that I remembered. And they were like, you know, silly, childish things, but, you know, they meant so much to me and to our family. You know, he had this huge heart, this softness about him. When he was around, you felt safe. He was funny. He everything kind of centered around Johnny, myself and my sister. You know, we were a close-knit family. And when that was taken, when his light went from us, it took so much from us. You know, it really did.
I think I remember, Susan, because I was there on the day that you delivered the pen portrait. I remember your one. It was a favourite song, Lovely Day by Bill Withers, I think it was.
Lovely Day, that was it. We used to practice that in the front room. We'd put the record down. We'd see who could hold the tone, you know, the longest, you know, the day part in it, you know. And we'd crack up laughing. Sometimes it would be me that could hold the Lovely Day note. Sometimes it would be him, you know. But his little party piece was the Huckle Book. He used to sing the Huckle Book and his knee would be going. And, you know, those are the memories that we have. You know, they were just wonderful, wonderful memories.
Susan Behan remembering her brother John, just one of the 48 people unlawfully killed at the Stardust nightclub 43 years ago. Back in a bit. Welcome back. December 1922 and the establishment of the Irish Free State. And now, over 100 years later, an exhibition at the Coach House at Dublin Castle. It's called Society and State Ireland Through Its Records. And lest you think that state records might be a little... think again. Director of the National Archives, Orla McBride, joined Ray.
All the records that are held in the National Archives, we have 50 million. So obviously this is only a snapshot. Right. Yeah, so this is 100 records.
Okay.
But we've chosen 100 records that we think tell the stories of the evolution of the Irish state. So once we were established in December 1922, the first thing the new government did was begin to build a new nation. So the task of state building, in effect. So the records that we have in the exhibition tell the stories of the state over those 100 years.
So we had to start from scratch.
We did, yeah. Oh, yeah. We did, yeah.
Like moving into a new house.
Like moving into a new house.
So you had to pick colours out.
So I have here before me, Ray, a little sample, which is the flag. So
right.
The tricolour. So we all know that the tricolour, obviously, was in existence before the new state came into being, but they had to formally approve the colours.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so what exact colour would the orange be? What exact colour would the green
be?
So they had to make those decisions. Then coinage, money.
Yes.
So they established a coinage committee so that they could choose the different denominations and the designs for the different
and
denominations.
And what animal or bird would go on
exactly.
The
exactly. And
coin.
The first two coins that were minted, the silver and the gold, were sent to the Vatican.
Right.
So even in those very early days in the 1920s.
Strong connection.
In the 1920s, that connection with the church had already been established.
Here's a tangential question here. Are there minutes of those meetings?
Yeah, we have all the minutes of every cabinet meeting.
But you know, the people choosing which bird, is it a hen or whatever, pigeon that we're going to put on a coin?
Yeah, they're all...
They're all there.
They're all in the National Archives. Yeah,
wow.
It's a treasure trove, really.
And it was. They talked about the measures to eradicate TB in Ireland, the introduction of free education, censorship and the lifting of the marriage bar.
And that was a precondition to our entering the EEC.
In 1973.
So in 1973.
I didn't know that. So it says you can join our club, but you have to allow women to work after they get married.
Equal pay for men and women.
Right.
So we had to...
So it wasn't specifically the marriage bar. No.
But the marriage bar was our obstacle to...
Yes, to equal pay.
You know, for any of us, my mother, the day she married, she had to give up teaching in a state school. So the 1970s, you can see that very significant social and cultural change that happened in Ireland. So we do have Ireland joining the EC, the lifting of the marriage bar, and then there's a wonderful letter from Mary Robinson, and it's to Cosgrave, and it's in 1973, and they're debating the legalisation of contraception in the Shannon. And she has to leave the debate, and she's really sorry she has to leave the debate. So she writes to the Taoiseach to say, you know, my apologies for leaving. But she had a dinner that she had to go to with her husband. Now, this is 1973.
Right.
And she said, and if I didn't go, he would have divorced me. Joking,
right.
Given that there's 73 and we didn't introduce divorce into Ireland until 1996. And then we do have a feature on Mary Robinson. Obviously, her election as the first female president of Ireland was extraordinary.
Huge. And we have a clip from her inauguration speech.
I was elected by men and women of all parties and none, by many with great moral courage who stepped out from the faded flags of the Civil War and voted for a new Ireland, and above all, by the women of Ireland, Manon O'Hearn. the women of Ireland, Manon Aheron, who instead of rocking the cradle, rocked the system.
Oh, and thank the archivist gods everywhere, because we can have a sneaky nose around the menu for the presidential inauguration dinner.
So they had smoked salmon in aspic vinaigrette, and then they had cream of spinach and dill soup. That was followed by roast poussin glazed with almonds, honey and mustard seed. They had palm coquettes, cherry tomatoes in basil cream sauce, braised chicory and garden peas. That was followed by a selection of Irish cheeses, and then they had chocolate parfait with raspberry coulis, symphony of winter fruits, and then they had coffee and petit four.
Right. So it was winter fruits. So it wasn't, what date was it? Do you have it that was it November? Was it November?
It was November.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, it's always November, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, because I remember she was on the den.
Actually, it was the third. The dinner, the banquet, was the 3rd of December 1990.
Right, so she would have been, elected in November, thereabouts, yeah.
And it was interesting even to look at the guests that were at the dinner, you know, that she had the Secretary General of the Council of Europe, she had John Hume, Gareth Fitzgerald, and, you know, and they very carefully, so they had the Secretary General of the Council of Europe, Catherine Lalumière, obviously French. They knew John Hume was fluent in French, as was Gareth Fitzgerald. Yes, so yes. They were both put on either side of her. So it was very carefully thought through in terms of even the seating plan.
Like a wedding. Yeah.
Oh, that does sound fascinating. And that exhibition, Society and State Ireland, through its records, and it's on at Dublin Castle. Horror, Shan knows, an unholy marriage, but ripe for a film from Paul Dwan. Its title, All You Need Is Death. Ian Lynch from Lancome composed the soundtrack.
The bed, Henry, in yon cave of the ratna aeth avel holsha iniske.
I think you'll agree, not exactly a toe-tapper, but good for a horror. That was Alwyn Fowere as Rita Concannon, written in early Irish, so there. And the premise of this horror... Well, if you've ever snuck your mobile phone out to do a sneaky recording at a session, you will never do it again, as Ian Lynch told Sean on Arena.
The story within All You Need Is Death, it's very much, as I said, about this idea of these song collectors who go getting a song from a really... She's infamous, I suppose, is what we'd say, rather than famous singer. But the rules are, you're not allowed to write the song down. You can't record it, or if you do record it, it cannot be for public consumption. Mm-hmm. Have you ever come across that kind of, you know, protection around a song?
Yeah, absolutely, I have, and I think that's why when I read the script first, it really struck a chord at me, no pun intended. It's definitely something, the transgression of that kind of rule, you know, and a lot of times it's an unspoken rule, but I definitely have come across that people expressing just... great anger that they found out later that somebody had been secretly recording a singing session or a song that they'd sang and it had ended up on the internet somewhere. That's something I've definitely heard people talk about a lot over the years.
And I'm guessing that's not about, oh, they took my performance and they made money out of it. It's about they're actually breaking the rules here. They're actually really breaking confidence. This was supposed to be a private performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think no one, if you're in a singing session, for example, and you're opening yourself up, you're vulnerable in a kind of very big way to know that maybe somebody is there recording who's going to then send around that recording to other people. You know, that could really just shake your confidence to do that. And I think that's why I liked about this film, that's the main transgression in the film that's made, and there's big, big consequences. Yeah,
now, this isn't realism in terms of what happens to people who disseminate.
Not that we know of, anyway.
Well, we hope not. because what happens is, as I said, it's a gore fest, it's a blood fest, what happens later on in the film.
A gore fest, no less, that'll learn you. And on the South Wind Blows, this.
You might have to stand up for this. We're going to give it over to you, it's the last one. Are you ready? Here it comes.
Well, that was recorded almost 10 years ago to the day, the 10th of April, 2014, in the Royal Albert Hall. The occasion was Kalura. Kalura means celebration, or it means remembrance. It means a little of both. And the evening was named by President Michael D. Higgins, who was on a state visit, an official state visit, to visit the Queen in 2014, topped the whole thing off in the Royal Albert Hall with a great gathering up of speakers and musicians. And it just was wonderful in every way.
And that night, the seed was sown for a new book from Tóner Quinn. He joined Aoife na Cormac on the rolling wave, and he is not doffing the cap to anyone.
The title of the book is brilliant.
Thank you.
What Ireland Can Teach the World About Music and Other Essays. So we should talk about the article which gives the book its title. What is it that we can teach the world about music?
Yeah, well, that's just one essay that I wrote. And I wrote it, the morning after the Kalura concert, which took place in London. And I saw once again this phenomenon where, you know, I thought it was fascinating that when the Queen came to Ireland, we put on a concert of Irish music. And then when Michael D went to London, we put on a concert of Irish music, or the English did. And I just thought, look at the power of this music. What do we have in this country? Do we understand it? And I wrote this article, What Ireland Can Teach the World About Music, where I tried to put forward three sort of suggestions for, is this what makes our music special? One of them was the spontaneity in Irish music. Now, we see it in traditional music, this idea that a group of musicians can get together, having never met before in their life, never shared any repertoire. They don't even need an audience, and they can play together for several hours and then never meet again. Now, that kind of spontaneity is extraordinary. Now, it happens in other places around the world, maybe not in the same way, but how did we get here? How do we arrive at this stage where that's quite normal? And not just normal for us who've been playing for years, but for teenagers. That I see these social media videos of them playing on trains, playing on planes, playing on the streets of the Fla, non-stop, playing everywhere. Where do they learn that spontaneity? Is it part of our nature in Ireland? Did we develop it? Is it due to our displaced nature, due to our colonised history? Is it our reaction to oppression? But whatever it is, it's a part of our Irish music culture, and then it spills out into other things.
Tóner Quinn on the rolling wave, borderline American in our can-do confidence. However, while we may well be gohintok fad, we're also failing quite spectacularly in other areas. Last One on the Train explores life in Ireland for wheelchair users, often what might be euphemistically characterised as challenging. And if you have additional needs, well, even more so. This week's episode featured Pádraig Sheler.
Good morning, Pádraig. It's very nice to meet you.
Yeah, hello. If you give him a moment, he is getting his hand up. Yeah.
Can we shake hands?
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you mind, Pádraig, I have cleared this with your mum and dad and I'm sure they checked in with you. If you don't mind, I'll do some recording with you today while you're going up to do your therapy and on sale. And
is that okay?
I hope that's okay.
Sorry, one is yes, two is no, three is I don't know. Like, you can ask him questions. But no, he was in favour of this because it has to do with human rights, and anything that has to do with human rights is... yes, is it definitely a big yes.
Pádraig with presenter Susan Dennehy. And Pádraig understands four languages, including Irish. In fact, he used to present a podcast on sale.
Fáilte stoch is Mr. Pádraig Sheler agus tá sibh géisteach leis an mangan mór ar Ireland an lifigh cé tú sé pon cathair FM. Seo Brian Adams, The Summer of 69, de Jenny.
Pádraig studied Irish and history at Trinity College, and after, he went Cape Cod on a J1 visa. But it was on June 27, 2013, that everything would change. Here is his mother, Pat.
You don't forget things like that. I came home and I was trying to finish something for my own work. So I went upstairs and I was sitting on the laptop, and I had a very good day. I'm thinking of that. It was a sunny day and I cycled home from town. And then my daughter rang me, my eldest girl, Laura from Berlin, and said, do you know, something's after coming up on Facebook saying, oh, Pádraig had an accident, and if you know him, please contact us. And I said, they're going round at the moment, those messages, just ignore it. And she says, oh, yeah, you're probably right. And then we left it. And then I was feeling uneasy. And just then she ran me back and she said, no, I think we should follow it up. So, yeah, I said, yeah. She was able to get a number from it. So I rang this number and it was a guest house where he had worked. He had just started to work there. And they said, oh, yes, I'll hand you over to the police officer. And that's when he said to me, he cycled out in front of a van. I always remember he said he cycled out in front of a van, ma'am, because it sort of rhymed. And he said, he's gone to the hospital. I said, is he alive? And he said, I think so. And then the phone call came saying, look, he's very badly injured. He's on life support.
They would learn that Porrick had not in fact cycled out in front of her van, but a truck had knocked him off his bike, resulting in a severe acquired brain injury. And as they all tried to come to terms with their new reality, the lack of services for young people like Porrick came as another shock. Here's Porrick's father, Reinhardt.
The first question that they'd asked us, you know, which nursing home is Porrick going to go to? That was a very serious, standard, normal question that they asked people, because that's the pathway, you know. And that's horrible for somebody of 23 years, you know, if you ask her, which nursing home are you going to go to? You know, it's incredible. And everybody knows that. The Ombudsman has published that report that there's at least 1,300 people, young people in nursing homes, inappropriately placed in nursing homes. And what is happening? You know, what has happened since he published that report?
You see, when we said, right, we're taking him home, and we were supported to get a home care package, and they say, oh, yeah, well, there's services available in the community. And then you come back and you discover exactly what's not available in the community, that a physio will come out for the first few weeks and then tell you his intervention is over. But that is the reality when you come out, that there was and still is nothing bar on sale for them.
And that interview was recorded on their way to On Sale, which is a day service that they had to establish themselves after seeing similar models in Reinhardt's native Germany. The centre offers Porrick and young people like him a place to go where they are not patients, but people who are challenged to fulfil their potential both mentally and physically.
10 years after Podrick's accident, Reinhardt sits in his office at On Sale. He created this place so that Podrick could have a decent quality of life. Does he believe he has succeeded?
Well, when you ask Porrick, 5 out of 5, he'd probably say, it depends on the day, you know, but on a normal day, he'd probably say 4, you know. And that is something that keeps us going, you know, because, like, I struggle, you know, and I cry inside a lot of the time, you know, because... And I admire him so much, you know, that in a situation that to us looks pretty dire, he keeps going, you know. And he, Porrick, can be so proud of what he has achieved.
Reinhardt, Pat and Porrick Shaler from The Last One on the Train. And from Lyric, here is just a little bit of beauty from Ambient Orbit. Listen to that all day. On Morning Ireland, meanwhile, black holes in the Milky Way. European Space Agency's Gaia mission spotted it. Francis McCarthy of Blackrock Castle Observatory in Cork joined Audrey, and as always, swig the coffee, sit back and prepare to have your little mind blown as you scratch your head at the mathematics.
This black hole, it is called Sagittarius A star. What does it look like?
Well,
Sagittarius A star is a different black hole. There's black holes all over our galaxy. Sag A star is the one in the centre of our galaxy, a supermassive black hole. The one that's been found through the Gaia mission is a much smaller, in some ways much more interesting black hole. It's 33 times the mass of the Sun, which in black hole terms is quite big when you start with a star, but small if you consider the massive ones that grow in the centre of galaxies. This is unusual because it's black holes are black. You can't see them. So detecting them is quite tricky. This one was spotted because the Gaia mission, which is a venerable mission, she's been out there in space for over 10 years, she looks at the position of stars and how they move and has spotted a star wobbling in response to something that we don't see. So you go put two and two together and say, must be a black hole that's making another star wobble around. Now, the wobbling star is very unusual in star terms. Stars are made of hydrogen and they're made of helium, and younger stars that have formed more recently are made of heavier elements as well. This one is metal poor. It's made of just mostly hydrogen and helium, and that might explain why the massive black hole that's next to it got to be so big.
And for stargazers everywhere, this is Christmas and birthday all come together.
What do you, Frances, as an expert in this field, think and feel when you hear about a new black hole being discovered?
I remember that the first black hole was discovered after I was born. They were considered a complete hypothetical. And it wasn't until we really started thinking in the late 60s and early 70s, hang on, it is possible for these to exist. They were absolutely just considered a complete curiosity. And I like the idea that, in fact, we can consider an entire new class of thing and then observe it into existence. But obviously it was there the whole time. We just had to change the way we think about it.
From Morning Ireland, and normally bending the old space-time continuum might be as good a place as any on which to end the programme, were it not for Tay-Tay. Swifties everywhere a tremble because yesterday a secret double album drop. The Tortured Poets Department. Here's Stevie Nicks' Don't Ask via Oliver via Michael D. Double Don't Ask.
He was in love with her, or at least she thought so. She was broken-hearted. Maybe he was too. Neither of them knew. She was way too hot to handle. He was way too high to try.
Oh! No dissing a Tay-Tay. As she might say herself, I can do it with a broken heart. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. I am not here next week, but talk to you the week after.